Welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Rees-Bedell, and I think I'm your host. On today's program, my pal John Anderson's in here with me. We'll run down some things going on with the FCC, like localism, or the lack thereof. Check in on what's going on with digital radio, so-called HD radio, and what might be going on with Low Power FM. We'll keep you up to date. You will want to stay tuned. You know, Jawa, I might just have to get you a permanent seat on the program here. It's an unelected
yes!
seat.
Yes! Yes!
Since, I mean, you no longer have that weekly outlet of the of doing media minutes.
No, but there have yet been any major fatal crashes at the intersection of media and democracy. So the traffic cops handling
they
that
jumped
are doing
in.
A pretty darn good job.
They had to replace you with two traffic cops there.
That's right.
Over there at Free Press's Media Minutes over at freepress.net. I get to monopolize you not quite as often.
Oh, and I just want to give one self-promotional plug if I could. My website, DIYmedia.net, for the past, I'd say 3 years, I've been collecting a political collage, what I call truthful translations of political speech. I have 498 tracks online now.
So you just need to find two more.
Two more, and we hit the big 500, which is five times as many as I thought I'd ever collect, but it is happening, it is going, and it is fun to check out. So
500, oots party over, out of time.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah, right. Nice.
All right, yeah, DIYmedia.net, that is a great archive of collage. You're in the mood to hear, especially George W. Bush, one of the most popular subjects, especially since digital editing became so much more widespread during the George W. Bush administration.
Yeah, but the best one I found so far has been a YouTube clip featuring clips of Adolf Hitler's Triumph of the Will set to a Biggie Smalls freestyle piece. So it looks like Adolf Hitler is actually Biggie Smalls freestyling. It's one of those weird juxtapositions that's blowing skinheads' minds as they're
yeah.
searching for, you know, Nazi propaganda on YouTube. It's
minds that need to be blown.
If there are any, those
are. So do you have a link to it?
Yeah, it's up there. It's up there.
DIYmedia.net. All right. Well, so the other day, Halloween, in fact.
Yeah, trick or treat.
A bit of a trick or treat. The FCC had its sort of last minute hearing on localism, which is really a smokescreen proceeding, which they've been holding on localism, started with the Michael Powell administration at
right.
the FCC.
Yeah, this has been something that was a sop to those who have been worried about consolidation within the media environment. And since Michael Powell effectively got, you know, slapped down by the courts when he tried to ram through media ownership rules in 2003, he decided that he would try to re-justify the media ownership rules in part by holding these hearings on quote-unquote localism, and the FCC's been dragging its feet. They promised to hold several hearings. They came up one short, and so they decided to hold the final localism hearing on Halloween Day as part of a regular FCC business meeting at FCC headquarters.
That's pretty local for
yeah,
most
that's,
people.
That's ultra local. The only people who spoke at the hearing were your garden variety experts and representatives of constituencies. There were people from like Free Press and the Consumer Federation of America who were there speaking on behalf of the public about localism. But it was all very theoretical and policy oriented. They did not actually open up the hearing to testimony from people to discover how local media, and in this case, that would be the DC metro area local media, have actually served the people that live in their backyard,
which
so
is at least something
really
they've
wasn't
done
much of a hearing at
with
all
with the media ownership hearing.
Yeah,
and that there was the ability for the public to speak at the local hearings,
not at this one.
And of course the thing about the localism hearing, right, it was Michael Powell's attempt to detach the notion of local service from ownership,
right,
up to the point at which he was telling people at one of the first hearings they had, you shall not speak the name ownership. You know, you shall not speak of ownership at these hearings because they're about local service.
Right.
And I don't believe that who owns your local media, whether it's a local person or not, should really have an effect on whether or not it serves you locally, which is something which research shows time and again. They're closely coupled.
Very much so. Very much so. You cannot do anything with with the ownership rules without affecting the localism of the media that is affected by those rules. The two are completely intertwined, and if you look back through FCC regulatory history, local service, especially in the context of radio and television broadcasters, has been something that way back in the glory days when the FCC actually, you know, cared about that type of material and considered those types of things during things like licensing, relicensing hearings, when they actually held hearings on whether radio and television stations should have their licenses re-upped, local service was taken into consideration. And the fact that it's attempting to be detached from the ownership proceeding, as you mentioned, is a way to fundamentally diminish the concept of localism as something that a broadcaster should actually functionally do for the communities they serve. It makes no sense. Now, that did not stop the public from attempting to actually have their voices heard. More than 150 people showed up in front of FCC headquarters and had an impromptu rally slash protest about the fact that, hey, we're rabble, we're the public, we care about local media, would you like to hear from us? Apparently not, so we're going to stand outside your door and make a lot of noise. Whether or not that it will actually affect the commission's business, especially as Kevin Martin drives towards this December 18th deadline on which he wants to pass these media ownership rules, is anybody's guess. My feeling is it probably won't. And I think that that feeling, my personal feeling, is justified by the fact that just this week, especially during the localism hearing, at least one of the Democratic commissioners came out and said, I have attempted to get information from commission staff on what the media ownership rule changes will be. And Chairman Kevin Martin has told commission staff that they can't talk to me, a commissioner. And I would like to remind commission staff that they work for the commission as a whole, not just at the behest of the chairman. This type of behavior makes Kevin Martin, compared to Michael Powell, I mean, it makes Michael Powell look like Big Bird Barney the Dinosaur.
It makes Kevin Martin look much more like Dick Cheney.
It is unbelievable how evil this man really is and how conniving and scheming and backdoor style. At least with Michael Powell, he got out there and shot his mouth off. And we all knew what he was feeling and what he was saying. But Kevin Martin is an insider, an operator, very politically savvy, keeping everything close to his chest in such a way that Michael Powell ham-handedly tried to do. And Kevin Martin is succeeding at doing this. And that means that come December 18th, the actual enlightenment of the commissioners on the rules they'll be voting on is going to be very slim. I can bet you that the three Republicans are going to have drafts on their desk within the next month. But I bet you, I'd be willing to put cash money down on the table about this, that the two Democrats on the commission will not have draft rules on their desk 7 days before they're supposed to vote on this stuff.
No, I'm certain. And that is one of the reasons why the Senate Commerce Committee just announced that it will be holding a hearing on localism and ownership coming up on November 8th.
Yes.
At least the two, the chairman and the minority leader on that commission are both very upset about the push to rush through the very end of this proceeding, which has dragged on now for years.
Yeah.
And we get towards the end and you see the light of the tunnel, and now Kevin Martin's making a breakaway sprint.
Yes, and I think that this is an act of political desperation. I think this is the last chance that a Republican-controlled FCC has to actually push through rules that favor the interest that they serve, which is corporate America. 2008 is an election year. This is a hot potato, and it is something that the commission and the Republicans who are running for election or re-election do not want to have to deal with as an issue, because they're on the wrong side of the issue by and large. The majority of Republicans in Congress are still on the wrong side of this issue. And so this is it. If Kevin Martin can't get these rules through by the end of the year, media ownership is going to be a dead issue at the FCC as far as rulemaking proceedings go until after the next presidential election. This is a Hail Mary pass. He's doing everything he can to run this through. And I have to admit that while it is nice to see some sort of discontent and a somewhat bipartisan discontent in Congress over these issues, let's remember what Congress did when the FCC rammed through its ruleship, media ownership rulemaking proceeding in 2003. The Senate rebuked
Right.
The FCC. And Congress eventually ended up passing a law which modified TV ownership caps to accommodate the current holdings of the current people who were over those caps. If you remember, it used to be that no one company could own more than enough television stations to reach 35% of the total American audience. Michael Powell's FCC wanted to raise that cap to 45%. That was initially struck down in the courts. However, the Senate and the House and Congress passed a law to raise the cap to 38%, which just so happened to be the reach that Fox had with its TV holdings. So did they do anything other than symbolically rebuke and chastise the FCC? No. Did they do something that substantively changed media policy for the worse? Yes. All rhetoric aside, they still were not our friends in this case.
And if the Senate and House could somehow be moved to pass a bill, which I doubt we would ever see under current circumstances, simply because of the slim majority in both the Senate and the House, that would overturn an FCC loosening of media ownership rules, I think we'd definitely see a veto, and that at least under President Bush, they wouldn't be able to get together enough of the 2/3 majority to overrule the veto.
Well, here's another thing that I think I'm comfortable saying and putting money down on. This one's going to court.
No, of course.
This one's going to court, and the public interest advocates like Prometheus Radio and the Media Access Project, which led the appeal in 2003, are hard at work right now, I can guarantee you, drafting briefs to file as soon as this thing is passed through the FCC.
And for Kevin Martin, that's not a losing proposition.
Right.
Right. I mean, if it goes to the courts and the courts hand it back, he has someone else he can point to.
Right.
Right. If he did his best, you know, he can look at the Bush administration, he can look at his pals at the NAB, he can kind of hold up his hands and I tried to do it again, and the courts don't want it to go down.
Yeah, but the way this FCC is shaping up, especially with the actions over the last couple of months where they put out the promised 10 studies and gave people 60 days on which to comment on the substance of those studies, the way that the localism hearing was held at the last minute and was completely non-local, the way that the last media ownership hearing is being haphazardly organized for, I think, next week.
It's
in
happening
Seattle.
November 9th, yeah,
okay.
Next week.
You know, I mean, it makes me almost pine for the Michael Powell days. It really does.
Because he was ham-handed, but he was all up front. And here, it's definitely, we're going to rush through the end of this. We're going to try and get it done. I think your analysis is absolutely correct. It is to get it done before the true end of the Bush administration, before it's too much a political hot potato. That it will ruin, you know, that certainly none of the Republican presidential candidates will want that chasing them around. They want this done and over with by the end of the year, but it just, well, it's not really going to happen.
Yeah, and I mean, we can see that there are issues, media issues, above and beyond just the ownership question, which are becoming campaign issues already. For example, the issue of network neutrality and data discrimination, both on wireless telephone networks and on the internet itself, is something that certain candidates, especially Democratic candidates like Barack Obama, have issued an official position on. I become president, I will advocate for the reissuance of legislation to guarantee network neutrality. I will free wireless phone customers from the contracts in which they are locked in. I will free up the use and accessibility of phones so people can transfer between network providers. The media issues are becoming core campaign issues, and the FCC sees the writing on the wall. They've got a 3-2 majority. I don't think we're going to have Robert McDowell being the wild card, as he was on things like the AT&T Bell South merger.
This one's too important, too close.
He's gonna take one for the team, and we're gonna see something ram through. And I really don't know if there's any way we can stop it, except for some really clever judicial maneuvering.
Pretty much, and that's
2003 all over again.
Exactly it is. And you are listening to Media Geek, your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. I'm Paul Reese-Mandel. I am your host. With me in the studio today is John Anderson of DIYmedia.net. Also, he is a doctoral student at the Institute of Communications Research. He specializes in the study of radio and media policy and how it affects our ability to communicate and be heard.
You make me sound so impressive. Thanks.
Yeah, you are impressive. That chair, I don't give just anybody a chair.
Right. Yes.
Check out Media Geek Online at www.mediageek.net. Go to radio show at radio.mediageek.net. And of course, if you have any comments, you can send them to me, paul@mediageek.net. Hey, you know, you mentioned net neutrality, and so I have to bring up Comcast, which I reported on last week, which has been interfering with the internet traffic of its customers who are running the file sharing program BitTorrent.
And also the program Nutella and the use of Lotus Notes.
Lotus Notes.
Yes.
Yes, Lotus Notes. because of its the level of traffic it creates. Yes. And so now a coalition of consumer groups and legal scholars want to put the FCC to the test with regard to how it stands on network neutrality. They're asking the commission to step in and stop Comcast from interfering with the BitTorrent traffic, which it is now copped to. They now admit that they're doing it, although they had to be caught in it by the Associated Press. Furthermore, Public Knowledge and Free Press are asking the FCC to fine Comcast $195,000 for each customer whose traffic Comcast has interfered with. The amount is based on a statutory minimum of $97,500 for a single continuing violation, doubled by what the group see as deception.
Willful and repeated violations.
And deception on the company's part, since Comcast didn't own up until they got caught red-handed.
Well, for those of us in the local listening area, I know your show is syndicated around the country now. But for those
and
of
Canada.
Us, yes, and Canada. You're international. But for those of us in East Central Illinois who happen to have a cable modem service through Insight Communications, Insight's been bought by Comcast. Next year, we will all be Comcast customers. This will affect you directly. If you don't have cable modem service, then you have DSL service through our good friends AT&T.
Yeah, we have such a diverse market of broadband service
so
here.
You got Evil One or Evil Two, and it's really hard to pick between the lesser of two evils right now. But do you want to live without broadband?
Yep, that's pretty much it. Unless we have the wireless broadband service here in town, which I had a Volo service, which is only here in Champaign-Urbana, though there are some similar services in pockets around the around the country.
But you have to remember that those services connect to the AT&T and or Comcast backbones.
Not all of them. Yeah,
most of them.
Peter was able to talk quite a bit more about it when he buys a commodity internet, but he's able to provide better service in some cases.
And there are issues where the backbone providers, which typically are AT&T and Comcast, have arrangements called peering, where they charge each other for traffic that is produced, and they can actually collude with each other to degrade or diminish service.
I don't offer it up as the ultimate panacea so much as to say
it's nice to know there may be an alternative out
there. For
most
people, you're talking about one of two choices, the two choices, neither of which is good. It's not a true market.
Nope.
It's a duopoly in most places, and that there are a few very small players who provide some differences and some opportunities, but have to do so through entirely different means, since access to the right-of-way is prohibitively expensive for them.
Well, as far as I remember, the FCC had instituted a notice of inquiry into the network neutrality idea. I don't know if they've actually finished
their
proceedings on that. But again, this is one of these things where the FCC has nodded sagely and said, yes, we will consider this issue, but we promise no action.
Well, what's interesting about it is that the word from the telecommunications establishment, the major industries about network neutrality has been, of course we support net neutrality in principle, and we don't see a need for law because, there's no problems. There's no violations. And of course, it's like, don't look here. That's not my hand in your pocket. And what's coming out is, indeed, this is exactly what's going on. Indeed, your internet traffic is being intercepted. I mean, the way Comcast does this is it actually spoofs that it's coming from your computer. It actually uses your IP and spoofs that it is running a BitTorrent client and sends the other BitTorrent peers the message, sorry, not available.
Right.
So it's actually spoofing like it's your computer, which really frightens me because I feel like, what if I'm in the middle of a credit card transaction?
Mm-hmm.
What if I'm in the middle of buying stocks or, playing poker online or
what
any number of
activities?
What if
I'm in the middle of trading non-copyrighted music?
Right. Well, especially.
What right does Comcast or any broadband service provider have to interfere with my ability to legally use applications?
Oh, I'll be bringing up this question next week where I go to an industry conference called Streaming Media West, which is about the online media industry, which is vaguely what I do for a living at the University of Illinois. And there are like two or three conference sessions on peer-to-peer as a content distribution network. Mm-hmm. BitTorrent is being turned into a way for people to get higher than YouTube quality video on demand or live by using peer-to-peer networks, realizing that often the pipes and the entryways of the internet still are not sufficient to serve so many users with broadband content, and they're looking at these peer-to-peer methods. I'm going to say, well, what do you guys have to say about Comcast? What does this do to your business model if they're going to block this if they're going to block this traffic? I mean, they're either going to want to have to cut a deal, want to be in on the deal with you, which, you know, is a direct hit to network neutrality, or they're just simply going to block your traffic.
Yeah, you know? And I mean, this has significant implications for the University of Illinois. I mean, we've got the National Center for Supercomputing Applications here. It's one of the most technologically advanced computer research facilities in the world. The majority of fiber running out of this campus is owned by AT&T.
Yeah. So network neutrality becoming more and more salient, shall we say. It's been important all along, becoming more and more salient.
But now it will start to affect you.
So let's move to from the land of broadband and back into the land of broadcast. One of the things we've talked about a lot of times in your appearance in the show has been digital radio, so-called HD radio, IBOC radio.
Yeah.
And the FCC had approved the nighttime usage on the AM dial. If anyone's listening to AM radio at night, they realize that, and except for some local stations or a few very powerful clear channel stations, it's just a mess.
Right.
It's hard to tune anything in because the waves just bounce off the ionosphere. And IBOC radio is a slightly bigger signal.
Three times as large as,
analog signal. Just slightly larger than analog signal. And the FCC, into this morass that we call AM radio at night, approved the use of this digital radio,
which created hash on the
dial. So how'd that work
AM
out?
Dials. It's not working out very well at all, actually. There has been what one could constitute as an engineer's revolt within the broadcast industry over the imposition of AM digital radio at night. Stations, for example, Cox Radio and Citadel Broadcasting, which is part of the ABC. They do the ABC radio network. They're the ones that are in charge of distributing ABC content. Those two major broadcast conglomerates have sent dictates down to their stations that are currently running digital at night, telling them to turn it off. Because the complaints of interference, not only between they and other stations nearby themselves on the dial, but between stations that they both own. Mm-hmm. One Citadel station in one part of the United States interfering with the Citadel station in another part of the United States. The nighttime interference problem due to the digital sidebands from AM IBOC broadcasting are so bad that these companies have turned off the signals at
night. Something which they'd been clamoring for and lobbying the FCC to approve the nighttime usage of this.
And then they finally got it and they realized, guess what? This technology is fundamentally flawed. The interference concerns were real. They are documented. The complaints are coming in. And there have been broadcast engineers at radio stations for these conglomerates that have been fired because they have said, I will not turn on these transmitters.
Because broadcast engineers tend to be a pretty, you know, the old school guys tend to be a fairly proud and extremely, shall we say, diligent lot.
A radio station, and especially an AM radio station, is kind of like having an old car that you really love and you tinker with and you want it to purr and you want it to run just right and sound just right. And a lot of engineers are what we call the golden ears, you know. AM is a relatively low fidelity broadcast medium. And to tweak a station to get maximal audio quality out of it is something that many AM broadcast engineers take pride in. The imposition of AM HD radio not only effectively degrades the quality of the digital broadcast by causing interference between other stations, but in order to accommodate the digital sidebands, they have to squeeze the amount of analog bandwidth available.
So the analog quality goes down.
Fundamentally degrades the analog quality. Nobody wins, and that makes engineers furious. And there have been some that have said, no, I will not turn this on. And program directors and general managers of stations have said, fine, turn in your resignation letters. And some of them actually have. There is a coalition called Stop IBOC. I think it's stopibok.com or stopibok.org of engineers, broadcast engineers, who are collecting information on the fundamental flaws of especially AM HD radio technology, are documenting instances where people have had to install this technology against their better technical expertise and judgment, and are collecting horror stories of this problem. This is a problem that is not going to go away. Cox and Citadel both say that they're working with Ubiquiti to figure out a solution to fix this problem. The problem is structural, and it's fundamental to the way that HD radio works, the capacity of the amount of bandwidth that it works, and how it uses that bandwidth. And unless you go back and redesign the entire AM side of this technology from the ground up, you're not going to fix this problem.
Which would only obsolete all the transmitters and all the existing radios.
Yeah.
Which isn't going to happen. And that's because in the U.S., a decision was to go with this one provider, one technology, and to shoehorn it onto the existing broadcast band, whereas in Europe, they chose to choose a new band to roll out digital radio services.
One other interesting point with regard to digital radio technology is that a consortium of both Canadian broadcasters and the Canadian Radio Television Commission, the Canadian version of the FCC, has just released a report, a technical study of digital audio broadcasting, the IBOC, Ubiquiti Standard as applied in the United States. They did not focus on the AM side, although they did reference the fact that there have been interference complaints with AM, but it basically talked about the FM side of the technology. And they have essentially recommended that the Canadian government not adopt or allow Canadian radio stations to possibly deploy this alternative technology. Canadian radio stations have already employed another digital format, which the rest of the world has pretty much already adopted. The United States, in many ways, is going it alone with this HD radio technology. But our neighbors to the north are very concerned that both on the AM and the FM dial, there could be a degradation of audio quality. There could be significant problems with interference between stations. And they are essentially saying, wait and see. Do not allow this technology to proliferate within our own borders. Wait and see how the U.S. market develops. And if you look at the listenership of digital radio right now, in any given week, more people listen to Democracy Now than listen to any digital radio broadcast signal, AM or FM. You can measure the number of people that are listening to digital radio in the hundreds of thousands, the low hundreds of thousands. And the best that the radio industry has been able to do has been to say they're going to spend $280 million on advertising revenue to pimp this technology. They're not subsidizing receivers to get them out into the market cheaper so that people will start buying them. They are not helping radio stations implement the technology, which, by the way, is proprietary and comes at a cost for every radio station that wants to put it on the air. Instead, they're doing a pure marketing push in a way to try to get this technology adopted both by broadcasters and by the public. Given the funding that they've already said they're spending, again, in ad inventory, not in direct cash outlays, but in ad inventory.
Meaning that, that's basically they're counting the cost those ads would have on the market. Yeah.
If you combine that with the new commitments that the HD Radio Alliance has made, we're now closing in on $750 million worth of quote-unquote investment.
For a few hundred thousand listeners.
And the technology is floundering.
All right, John, thank you once again. I think we're up to date. Till next week.
Yeah. Thanks, Paul.
Check out John's website, DIYmedia.net. So in addition to the truthful translations, 498 of them, you can find out more about what's going on in the world of radio, low power pirate, IBOC, and other important media issues. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm host and producer Paul Riesmandel. I'll be back in 1 week with another half-hour look at independent and grassroots media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. In the meantime, check out the frequently updated Media Geek blog at MediaGeek.net. The program can also be downloaded at Radio.MediaGeek.net, where you can subscribe to the podcast. Media Geek is produced at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, and is heard on 10 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, WYQZ in Warrenton, Bealeton, Virginia, KWMD Kasilov in Anchorage, Alaska, WVEW in Brattleboro, Vermont, and Free Radio Olympia Media in Olympia, Washington. It's also on the web at Free Radio San Diego, Pirate969.org, and RadioDriftless.org. Media Geek is free to air on your local non-commercial station, too. Just email Paul at MediaGeek.net. That's also where you can send comments about the program, Paul at MediaGeek.net. Thanks for tuning in.